Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's a complete no man's land. It's not formally owned or controlled. Well, it is owned. It's owned by Panama and Colombia, but it's not controlled by them. And it's an area where drug runners, immigrants on their way from Africa to America. So there's a bizarre immigrant route where you fly from Senegal, pretty much, as how most people do it, into South America, because it's easier to get in at South America. And then you go by bus all the way up through South America, through Ecuador, Colombia. Then you go by boat, get to the Darién Gap, and then you trek through a 6-day trek, which again is, you know, the people die along the route. But it's so wild that the authorities won't chase you through. So it's like the Wild West. You know, there are drug runners, there are immigrants, there are all sorts of people there. And there are fascinated economic trades between them all.
Alice Denby, Deputy Editor of CapEx, and for this week's podcast, I spoke to economist Richard Davies. Now, I say he's an economist, but not many number crunchers have trekked through lawless jungles, visited shops and restaurants in the world's most entrepreneurial refugee camp, or hung out with inmates in a Louisiana mega jail. Richard's been to some of the most desperate places on the planet, but found incredible stories of human resilience, and that the innate need to trade means people with nothing can create new markets and currencies from scratch. His book, Extreme Economies, examines what policymakers can learn from disaster zones, displaced societies, and failed states. So I began by asking what advice he has for a world ravaged by the global pandemic.
Richard Davies, thank you so much for joining me for the CapEx podcast. For your book, Extreme Economies, you travelled to some of the most challenging places on the planet, an island destroyed by the tsunami, and the world's biggest refugee camp. What do you think a world devastated by the global pandemic can learn from some of these places?
I think the first thing to say is that human beings are incredibly resilient. And in all of the places that I went, I certainly ended up feeling some chinks of optimism. That might seem sort of totally blasé and rose-tinted to say at a time like this, but I think it is worth remembering that some people in the world have been through even tougher situations than COVID. And actually the way that they respond, the way they adapt, the way they jump forward, start using new technologies, the way they cooperated together was all kind of really striking to me. So that's the sort of upside. The downside is that in lots of the places I saw pretty big policy errors, frankly, often benign governments deciding to do something that they thought would help people and actually pretty much was unhelpful or even undermining. So big picture, the book is really, it's all about human resilience. It's narrative, economic stories from literally the toughest places on earth. You know, the Louisiana State Penitentiary, the jail I went to, it's really harder to think of any more kind of barren and economic soil, really. There's nothing, you start with nothing there. And yet people are able to rebuild even within the walls of a penitentiary. So that's the really hopeful side. The downside is that there are places all over the world that have essentially got stuck in a rut and never got out of it. So it's a kind of knife edge.
I think what I really loved about your book is exactly as you say, it's a real keen to the resilience of the human spirit. And even in those places that you visited, like the Zaatari refugee camp and the Louisiana jail, you just sort of paraphrased Jurassic Park, the free market found a way.
It did, yeah, absolutely. And completely informally, completely without support, and more than that, actually with the active attempts to control or restrain the economy. So the first section of the book, as you say, is all about, it's essentially resilience on trial and like the triumph of resilience. It's kind of probably the most optimistic part of the book, which is weird because the three places are the most barren. So how did they do it? I think it's kind of interesting to discuss. One thing that I didn't realize, and your listeners will be interested in, I hope, I didn't intend for this to happen, but the book in a way ended up being partly a kind of study of hidden finance, basically. So hidden currencies, hidden trading systems, informal insurance mechanisms that people have put together. And just to talk about a couple of them. So in the Louisiana jail, it's quite famous in economics and the kind of history of economics. People have always been interested about these outsider currencies. The fact that actually, on the face of it, we kind of think that the Bank of England or the Fed or the ECB are, you know, the absolute bedrock of our economy. You know, the look of money is a kind of akin to the flag or the national anthem. It just seems so official and so stable and sort of, you know, the answer. But it's worth remembering that, you know, for a long time, central banks didn't exist and currencies did. I mean, the Fed's only just over 100 years old, right? Set up after the 1907 crisis. And people very, very quickly, like overnight in these places, come up with a new currency. Why is that? Fundamentally, I think it's a really interesting thing, is that I came away from those places feeling that the human urge to trade and exchange is innate, actually. I believe that now. And why is that? It's basically because when some big shock happens, and we can think of that in the context of COVID, they're basically winners and losers. And anytime there's winners and losers, some people have got some assets or some resources or some skills. Other people don't have those things. That sets up an opportunity to trade. And in these places, they come up with their own currencies. So in Aceh, gold bangles were used as not really a currency, but like an informal saving mechanism that hugely saved the entrepreneurs of Indonesia. Because they were able to very quickly liquidate that gold. In the Louisiana prison system, I found all sorts of bizarre different currencies, from pot noodles to cans of mackerel to this really weird and interesting thing, the scratch card prepaid debit cards, which is used as a currency. And in the Zaatari refugee camp, I found that they were using powdered milk essentially to smuggle that out and free themselves from this kind of lockdown designed currency, where they had to use a specific type of debit card, which they didn't want to use. And so they buy all this powdered milk, ship it out, swap it for dollars and dinars, and then build their own cash economy. So in all three cases, there's a huge urge to rebuild a market when you didn't have one. And one of the first things you need to do is actually to establish a currency. And they did that completely informally and without any state help.
Yeah, and it's fascinating how that sort of urge to have freedom of choice shone through in these pretty desperate places. But I think your book also reveals that there's kind of also an innate human need to have a state. So in Kinshasa, for example, where you describe it as a corruption superstructure, the state taxes people heavily but provides no public services. People sort of informally privatized their own public services.
Yeah, that's that again was just completely bizarre and something I wasn't really expecting. And Kinshasa is probably the place that changed my view of how we think about economies and even how we think about something like corruption completely. So just to give the bigger picture, the middle part of the book, so we talked about these three amazing places where people have proved their resilience. The middle part of the book is the sort of flip side of that. It's places that should be incredible yet have actually become basket case economies. And for me, the biggest failure of the last century in terms of economics is probably the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, on any measure, mineral wealth, the rainforests, the Congo River itself, which could be the source of huge hydroelectric power, just the human toll. It's one of the top 10 biggest countries just by population. It just has all of the, it speaks a European language, it's on a European time zone. Any economic analysis you could do before you knew the name of the country, if you saw those things, you'd predict, oh, this is going to be a successful economy. And yet it's literally the bottom of the pack. So, and going there, I mean, the statistics don't lie. When you get off the plane and you drive in, it's just corrugated iron shack after corrugated iron shack, just forever, just for like an hour's drive. People with absolutely nothing. The level of poverty is incredible. And you're right, what has happened is this strange phenomenon where people essentially tolerate corruption because they understand that public servants just aren't going to get paid. And so you kind of have to pay them these small bribes. And it's just become so regular that actually it's more like you're just paying for them and they're private, but they're not private, they're part of the state. So just to give a picture of what that's like, just a simple example. Obviously, as a sort of Westerner, I was lucky enough to, you know, be able to afford a driver, and we went around in a car. And when you park on any street, it's and you need to change direction. I mean, the traffic is terrible. The roads are massive underinvestment, as you might imagine. But the main thing is that most people don't travel that way, they walk. And it's a city of 10 million people with the infrastructure of a kind of small market town, basically. So the streets are absolutely full of people, like more full of people than you could ever imagine. So say you're in this car, I mean, you can either just, if you're in the car's facing in the wrong direction, you're literally got a really big problem, because it might be sort of 2 hours drive to do the loop round this road and sort of turn and turn and turn again. So you need to do a U-turn. And it's absolutely impossible to do that in these crowds. So what you do is, wherever you are, and when you go to a car, there will be a policeman or woman. One of the interesting things about Congo actually is that the gender roles within the state, I'd imagine that they would all be men sort of doing, getting these bungs and stuff. But that seems to not be so much of an issue there. So it's often actually police women. And as you approach a car, one will appear, because they're absolutely everywhere. And you just give them a small payment, very low, like about a dollar or half a dollar. And they'll just sort of stop the crowd and allow you to do your U-turn. Now, obviously, in one sense, that is corruption, because they are supposed to be paid by the state. You're paying them and to sort of move people off the road and to stop traffic. Like, why is that okay? But after a while, talking to the Congolese people that I was with, you know, this happens with school teachers, it happens with the doctor, every single thing you have to do. And you say, you know, aren't you angry about this? And they say, well, you know, because they're just literally not going to be paid. So we have to pay them, otherwise they won't do their job. And not because they're living in a mansion. I mean, they will literally starve. So the economy in Kinshasa is so warped that you come away from it. You know, we are trained in the West to think corruption equals bad. Actually, there it just equals survival. And you don't come away from these interactions thinking that people doing it are bad people. They're not, they're just trying to get by.
So interesting. And your book's not just a book about economy. It's a travel book as well. There are sort of shades of the intrepid Victorian exploring. You trek through the lawless jungles and the Darien Gap. Can you tell us a bit about sort of how, what that was like, some of the adventures you had?
Oh, thank you. That's very kind to say. So, yeah, the aim with the book was to try and do something that non-economists and people that aren't interested in finance and aren't interested in, you know, where the economy is going, but they are kind of interested in, you know, roughly where their lives are going, would like. And because I basically think that the biggest biggest stories in economics are untold. That's my sort of part of my motivation. I've been part of that. You know, I wrote for The Economist magazine for 5 years, and you know, I churned out all my pieces on the ECB and the Bank of England. And, you know, yesterday I would have been doing the Treasury spending review. The truth is there are these absolutely incredible places. So just one, the Darien Gap. I mean, even if readers want to get the book, by the way, we've got a link so they can get a signed copy sent out that I think we're going to put in the notes. But even if they don't want to, I'll stop the sales pitch. Just look up the Darien Gap, because it is absolutely fascinating. The sort of bullet point summary is this weird place in between Panama and Colombia, at the very thinnest part of Central America. Because of that, in the 1600s, it was literally famous in the UK. There were best-selling books written about it. And the reason is that, if you just sort of picture that in your mind, that it was called the key to the universe. And that was because everybody in Britain in that time was obsessed by trade. Trade was really taking off. And it had the opportunity, this place, of linking both North America and South America. So it's a land bridge. And then, as 200 years later, we found with the Panama Canal, it potentially links the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. So there was this obsession with the Darien Gap. So that, I mean, that's just kind of interesting to me as knowing about history. But then the really interesting thing is that this place, completely unknown, actually is the reason that the UK as a United Kingdom exists. And it exists because the Scottish, who wanted to create a much stronger, make their economy much stronger, decided they needed an empire and invested hugely in this expedition that went there. It's known as the Darien Disaster. And on some accounts, it wiped out over a quarter of Scottish wealth. You know, the entire financial class invested in this thing. They sent people there. It was an absolute disaster. They literally, people died. Anyway, so I went there. I found the place. I literally found the beach where the Scots landed. It's actually controlled by this, I don't really write about this in the book actually, but it's controlled by this indigenous tribe called the Kuna, K-U-N-A, and it's part of the Kuna Yala, which is this tract of land that they've been given. And they massively protect it, so you actually can't get onto the beach. So you can drive past this beach and just look at it and think that 400 years ago, intrepid Scots, five ships of them, sailed there. Most of them end up dying. It's the reason our country is called the United Kingdom. And there's, you know, there's no monument, there's no little sign saying the Darien Disaster, it's just a sort of empty beach. So it's an example of how, you know, like, there's hugely interesting economic stories in the world. What's going on there now is this is sort of less fun in a sense, because it's a complete no man's land. It's not formally owned or controlled. Well, it is owned. It's owned by Panama and Colombia, but it's not controlled by them. And it's an area where drug runners, immigrants on their way from Africa to America. So there's a bizarre immigrant route where you fly from Senegal, pretty much, as how most people do it, into South America, because it's easier to get in at South America. And then you go by bus all the way up through South America, through Ecuador, Colombia. Then you go by boat, get to the Darien Gap, and then you trek through a 6-day trek, which again is, you know, that people die along the route. But it's so wild that the authorities won't chase you through. So it's like the Wild West. You know, there are drug runners, there are immigrants, there are all sorts of people there. And there are fascinated economic trades between them all. The downside and the really worrying bit about that place is also an informal and unregulated trade in hardwoods. And the environment is really being destroyed at quite a pace. And that's a kind of corrective, I guess, for some of the stories in the first part of the book, which basically are very capitalist, market loving. This is an example of actually, if you let the market go completely to its own accord, particularly in something where you're trading the environment, you can end up with pretty bad results.
Yeah, I think you talk about it as a market that consumes its own value.
Yeah, it's fundamentally short term, because there's only so much wood. It's not the Brazilian rainforest. So I wanted to sort of, because in a way, and you hit the nail on the head. So I obviously wanted to tell what I thought were important economic stories, and obviously the environment is one. But I'd always, and I hope that sort of came across, just been fascinated by this place, the Darien Gap. By the way, it's called the Gap because the Pan American Highway, which is championed by some people as one of the most amazing, it is also one of the most American, largely funded by America, the most amazing infrastructure projects in the world. Okay, the Pan American Highway goes all the way from Alaska in the north to the tip of Argentina in the south. It doesn't. It's not Pan American. It breaks because they were never able to build it through this weird place, the Darien Gap. So, you know, I just wanted to go there, but I also wanted to touch on the environment in the book. And it's just, you can just see sort of what's going on a much larger scale in Brazil, I guess, in a tiny, tiny place. And you can meet all the players and ask them what's going on. And for an economist, you know, the jargon we would use is externalities or some sort of negative spillover. And literally in this town, this one town, I was able to interview all different types of people, from loggers to official who are allowed to do it, to then these people who go in and just take a few branches here and there. And then cattle herders then take their cattle in, but then the cattle just, you know, graze and destroy everything, destroy all the roots coming through. And then people who replant, and instead of replanting the indigenous trees, they replant teak because it's valuable, and also there's a subsidy from the Panamanian government. So you've got all these players, the indigenous tribes, the loggers, informal and formal, the replanters, the farmers, and each one of them is just sort of acting actually quite reasonably. I mean, they're not really taking account of what they do, but they're not doing anything like really, really bad. But when you add it all together, it just produces this market, which, as I say, and as you quoted, it just consumes its own value, and it just won't be there in 10 years. And they'll have undermined themselves because they won't be able to do anything like ecotourism or anything sustainable.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And talking about sort of the free market gone wild, I think you also observed some of that in Chile, which on paper is, you know, the second most prosperous place in South America. But I think you said that the kind of Chicago School of Economics has actually caused sort of problems and inequality in their capital in Santiago.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, so Chile's another sort of great example. And if anybody's at all interested in it, there's a fantastic documentary, which is in Spanish, but it's got English subtitles, and you can find it on the web. And it's called The Chicago Boys. And this is all about soft power, basically. So it goes back to 1930s and America deciding that they wanted to do more soft power and less actual military intervention. And this then, you know, built up this idea through to the sort of 60s and 70s. And what that meant was you give your advice to places. So you send scientists to places, you send architects to places, you send infrastructure experts, and you sort of help countries build themselves up. And you also portray a positive image of America. And one of the ways they did that was through economics. And they did this deal between the University of Chicago, which was at the time home to Milton Friedman, so, you know, the sort of canonical market-loving economist, and the major university in Chile, which is the Catholic University in Chile, in Santiago. And these, it was just an exchange thing. They went there for 2 years and they came back, and the documentary tells it very well. And I managed to sort of get hold of some of these guys, and they were kind enough to let me interview them. And to cut a very long story short, essentially what happened is Chile had an experiment with socialism in the late 60s up until about 72 under Allende, who was the president there and is still like very much the hero for a lot of people. That didn't work. It ended up in a general strike. There's all sorts of conspiracy theories about whether the CIA funded all this sort of stuff. I just kind of set out the evidence. I didn't sort of try and prove or disprove that in the book. But then basically what happened is Pinochet takes over, and you have, as a dictator, military dictator, and you have what one person called the most extreme example, the most extreme experiment in free market capitalism in the world. So essentially, and again, I'm cutting through a lot of nuance here, but all the historians say that Pinochet didn't know anything about economics. And oddly, he didn't run the economy in a very army-like managed way. He essentially gave it over to this group of economists who put together a blueprint, which is known as El Ladrillo, which is the brick. They literally had one document which says, this is how we're going to run the economy. And then they did that for about the next 25 years. I mean, no other economy, you know, some economists would like to do that. They have very clear ways that they'd like to run an economy. No one else has ever done that. And so, yeah, I wanted to go there and just understand it. And I mean, I could do two or three whole podcasts on this topic, but the thing that comes from it is, it's the sort of thing that if you have to go and see, or you have to have a whole book chapter on, because in our modern sort of way of news media and Twitter, all the rest of it, you're just not going to get it across, because two things simultaneously are true. One thing is that Chile has had outstanding economic performance, and the people on the ground, the very poorest people who I sought out, they really value that. And so in our general narrative we have at the moment, people on the left wouldn't accept that, right? They'd say neoliberalism, it's terrible for everyone, it's terrible for the poor. That's just not true. It's not true for the poor. The very poorest people in Chile really valued this extreme growth rate, because some of it did trickle down to them. So that is true. The other thing, which is simultaneously true, is that the extreme economic inequality, which defines Santiago, so a tiny vignette, when I got off the plane and got in a taxi going into Santiago, I said, I'm here to do a chapter all about the economy of the city. And the guy said to me, which city? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, there's at least five cities here, depending on how much you earn. And that's the way they think about it. They literally don't live geographically in the same part of the city. The rich people live in the north, the poor people live in the south, there's a line called the Plaza Italia in the middle, and you do not cross it. And so I said there's something on the left people have to accept, on the right people that sort of love the free market have to accept that that level of inequality is fundamentally damaging to the social fabric of a city and to people at the bottom. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, definitely interesting, and it's something, I don't know what the right answer is, but I just know it's hugely interesting and it's good to understand. And then after literally about 2 months after I finished the book and I put my conclusion, you know, the one place I'm a bit worried about is Santiago, then we just saw the huge riots. So, you know, I don't count myself as some sort of amazing forecaster for doing that, because basically if you'd been there and spoken to people, I mean, anyone would have predicted it, because they're all fed up with the system. So
why is Glasgow an extreme economy?
Glasgow is an extreme economy because it is a message for all of us that live in cities which specialize in one thing, that our lives are on a knife edge and we don't know that they are. So in short, Glasgow rose on the back of shipbuilding. It first rose on the back of tobacco, and that's the beautiful old heart of Glasgow. And then it rose on the back of shipbuilding. And shipbuilding was the most important industry globally, I argue. And I argue that Glasgow is, you know, goes down along with Rome as one of the most important cities in the history of the world. And most people don't know that. So in part, this was just motivated by me wanting to champion Glasgow. I love Glasgow. To take anything, like, it had the third underground system and the only one that wasn't powered by steam, so it wasn't filthy like London and Budapest. Kelvin and Watt, you know, actual fundamental measures of how we measure the world, they come from Glaswegian scientists. The Impressionist movement, in a sense, you could say, in art, started because Glaswegian traders started buying up that art because their art dealers were so forward thinking. So at the turn of the 19th century, it literally was a hub of industry, culture. It was like Silicon Valley now. People were moving there to be part of what was going on in Glasgow. And it's an extreme economy because it went from that in the space of 50 years to being easily Europe's most troubled place. So male suicide rates, drug use rates that were unseen anywhere else in Europe. And so that, how you, it's like a kind of Icarus city, how you go from flying so high and being the best basically to being the most troubled was something I really wanted to understand.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about kind of Glasgow's decline, but I want to stick up for Glasgow because I've got family there and I love it as well. And it's one of the most creative cities in the country and in Europe. I mean, it's had 6 Turner Prize winners, 10 nominees, you know, it's got poets, it's got bands like Biffy Clyro, and the Booker Prize winner who has just won it is also a Glasgow writer. So I think you can see, you can talk about the decline of industry, but the creativity of that city has never died.
Yes, I saw that, the Doug something.
Shuggie Bain is,
but yeah, yeah, it looks really interesting. It doesn't surprise me at all. And a few people, you know, because I'm from the south, I guess, was born and I grew up in Dorset, said to me, oh, you know, you're brave saying that Glasgow is a sort of failed economy and is an extreme economy. I said, well, not really, because if anyone reads it, they'll see that what I'm trying to say is that this is one of the world's most amazing cities. And of course, if you are one of the world's most amazing cities, there's obviously something good in the water as well as something bad in the water. And as I say in the book, the fact that it's got these amazing literary figures, even today, those people are in a long line that go back hundreds of years. It still is true, though, that if you go to the east end of Glasgow rather than the west end, it's hugely depressed, and you know, joblessness is rife. The life expectancy fell for a long time in Glasgow. So there's this thing in the States at the moment, I'm not sure if you've seen Deaths of Despair, this notion of Deaths of Despair. It's based on a book by Anne Case and Angus Deaton that they did a couple of years ago. Well, Glasgow had Deaths of Despair, and people were writing about that 10 years ago. There's this thing called the Glasgow effect. People just die too young. And so in a way that I wanted to make it a sort of central part of my book. It's the only UK place I discuss. I don't discuss London. I actually don't think big picture. I don't think London's that interesting from a long historical sweep. I think Glasgow is far more interesting, and that's why I focused on it. And we just have to accept as a country that we had a gem, an absolute gem, which could have easily rivaled London. My family's from Manchester, so I'll be unpopular for saying this, but there's always this thing of which is Britain's second city, and Mancunians was like, it's Manchester. It's not, for the reasons you say and the reasons that I set out about being the city that drove globalization. Glasgow literally drove the first globalization by inventing the steel-hulled ship. It's definitely Britain's second city. And the fact that even as great as it is, which you say, it should be, if we'd managed the economy well and managed to and not made these mistakes, it should be way, way stronger than it is.
Yeah, I mean, you do make quite a compelling case about particular policy decisions that have been bad for Glasgow, in particular around housing.
Yeah, so I think there's two things that happened. The first is more something that I guess I should comment on, or like is more kind of my focus of expertise as an economist, and also as an economist that's worked a long time within government. And that was the treatment of the shipping industry, which again, as a little plug for something to watch, there's and Sean Connery has just died. There's an amazing documentary. I think the only documentary that Sean Connery ever did, where he directed it and starred in it, and it's called The Bowler and the Bunnet, referring to the hats that the kind of managerial class and the workers would wear in the Glaswegian shipyards. And it's filmed at this time in the late 60s where the shipbuilding industry is on a knife edge. And I'm afraid, and it's not a party political thing because it lasted for sort of 25 years, it's really like a Westminster thing. There was just a failure to grapple the extent of overseas competition and to help the Glaswegian shipping industry and the UK shipping industry in a way that made any kind of economic sense. And I go through it in more detail in the book. You don't need to be an expert to understand that the things they're doing didn't stack up. And so Glasgow was undermined in that sense. The second reason, which is a bit more controversial, is with reflects on the tenement system, which I'm not saying that some tenements weren't squalid and that some of them, you know, some people did need to have better housing. Of course, that's true. It is also the case that if you go to Glasgow and you find people, particularly around Govan and Gorbals, south of the river, places just close to where the heart of the shipbuilding industry would be, where huge street after street after street of tenements were raised to the ground, and then people were moved out onto these peripheral estates which had no community spaces, no pubs, no shops. Those people have a huge sense of loss still about the fact that their communities, as the tenements were destroyed, their community was destroyed. And every part of their social fabric, and I would say social capital, so neighbours that they would trade and exchange informally with, stuff that you wouldn't capture in an economic statistic, but it's a fundamental part of the lifeblood of the city, that was destroyed. So I came away thinking that, I mean, of course, hundreds of things have happened in a city over 50 years, but the two really big things you need to know about Glasgow are shipping, and we should have protected that more, and tenements, and as we were improving them, we should have realised that you need to support the community and not just build a load of new houses on the outskirts of the city.
Yeah, I think one of the really interesting things about your book is that you found sort of clear policy errors, but there's something much more intangible as well. There's, you know, the importance of these informal economies and of human capital. So, I mean, again, sort of thinking about the pandemic, what do you think governments can do to harness all that creativity and human energy, which, you know, Glasgow clearly has, the UK has in spades? How can the government harness that to help us recover?
One of the things that I'm concerned about where we sit right now is the kind of fracturing of national policy and of a kind of national spirit, I guess. So what I mean by that is, and look, this is hugely difficult. And I think one of the things that I should say, that one of the mistakes that economists make, and I specifically didn't do this with the book, although, you know, some people sort of have said I should have done more, but I didn't want to do this, is just go to a place and then think you've got the answers about everything. You know, this is a book of I hope, really interesting stories about places that I hope people would read and then reflect on how the economy works. It's not one of those books that's like, you know, all 10 ways to mend the economy. Because let's face it, anyone that writes a book like that is talking nonsense, because they haven't got 10 ways in every single scenario to mend the economy. But, you know, I should, as somebody who spent most of my working life in policy, have some ideas. And the thing that I'm worried about is the following. There's really good evidence, so statistical proper studies, that when a common shock happens to society, actually that creates cohesion, it creates cooperation, supports social capital, and that actually helps you overcome it. And those are studies particularly with things to do with sort of natural disasters and so on. And you can imagine why that might be. There's a kind of common enemy. We're all in it together against this tsunami or against this earthquake or whatever it is. And I definitely, and that's a theory that, you know, social scientists have studied. And I definitely saw that in my much more narrative interview-based approach, talking to the people of Indonesia who'd faced the huge tsunami waves. The thing I'm worried about now is that in the first phase of the coronavirus, we had this very national approach, you know, Thursday night clapping for the NHS. And there really was a kind of spirit of togetherness. And then sometime through the summer, when things got relaxed, but then cases started going back up, and, you know, the rules around what should be going on in Manchester versus the rest of the country, all that sort of stuff, it really started to fracture. And I'm concerned about that, because if you have one set of rules, you know, in Wales, and one set of the rules just over the border in Bristol, you know, it's like a 20-minute drive, that undermines that sort of level of cohesion. And, you know, Manchester's getting a different deal to London. What kind of funding are they getting? What kind of funding are we getting? And I think you're starting to see that, you know, we're not seeing any clapping anymore for anyone. And the erosion of the a public, by which I mean all of us together doing the same thing approach. And so that's something which study, like doing this book, has changed my thinking of, because for an economist it's the wrong answer, right? So with my pure mainstream economics hat on, I would say, and which is what the government has been saying, if there's different conditions in different places, you obviously should fine-tune your policy in those places. You should fine-tune your lockdown policy in those places and your lockdown support. And that's the sort of straight up economic policy argument. I think there's a bigger thing, and you said it really well, there's this like intangible like mesh that connects us all. In some sense, it's a bit better just to do everything as a country because of that, I think. And so that's something that I'm a bit concerned about at the moment. I think the government should be thinking more about.
Richard, I think that's probably all we have time for, but people want to read his excellent book, Extreme Economies. You can visit www.extremeeconomies.com/signed. And if you enter the code CAPEX, you'll get a signed copy for the special price of £7. And that is
exactly
the ideal Christmas gift for the economist in your life.
Or the non-economist, especially the non-economist. I hope non-economists read the book. Economists read enough economics books. They can read something else. But no, this one's for the non-economists to tell them that economics isn't all boring and equations and stuff. It's about real people in very interesting places, I hope. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.